All right, welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and here we are in the fabulous studio Fist in Your Face in Salt Lake City with another fantastic studio audience. This is a podcast I've been looking forward to for a long time. It's a subject near and dear to my heart, but we'll get into that in a minute. First, I'm joined by my companion for the evening, the lovely, because you're sitting to my left, the lovely Bill has rejoined us. This is your second go, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Bill.
All right. I'm a Utah Countyite. Liberal Democrat living in the middle of the reddest part of the state, and just a history buff. I'm chair of Sunstone Foundation, and very very fascinated in this particular topic. The whole Red Scare and the church has just been endlessly fascinating, and I was the Democratic candidate in my district in Alpine, garnered a whopping 12% of the vote.
Which, as we were talking before, is probably the best you could have done no matter what.
Right, no matter how hard I campaigned, that 12% is – but I figured people needed to have some, you know, another thing to check off.
I take that back. If Jesus Christ had endorsed you, you might have got up to 14 or 15.
That's right. That's possible.
All right. Well, welcome. I'm glad to have you. I think this will be a fun one tonight. Before we get into the topic at hand, first of all, the news. Well, before, let me mention, I've mentioned it on the podcast a couple of times. I finally got the kinks worked out. It is up and running. So this little studio here that we're sitting in right now is used not only to record this podcast, but a few others. And it's used for things like group therapy sessions and for educational classes and just a lot of different things that it might be hard to do in somebody's living room. It's a great space for that. And in 2015, we want to open it up even more. It has always bugged me about Mormon churches. And when we're in the state of Utah, there's tons of them. They're these wonderful, enormous buildings. And they have all of this, you know, great facility. They have a great kitchen. They have a stage. They have, you could do anything with those buildings, right? And they're empty like all the time. And there's tons of them. I mean, you can imagine if the church were just to throw its doors open. What could we do with those buildings? It would be not the perverted things that you guys are thinking about. I'm talking about like good community things. Well, I want to take that ethos towards this center because, you know, we have a projector. We can seat about 30 to 40 people in here. And, what we've launched is a campaign to cover the operational costs of this place. And the operational costs, for a year are approximately $9,000. To keep these doors open. So we've launched a campaign for the first half of that. I'm only going for the first half. And by the end of 2015, we want to gather the funding. I have a website that's helping us do it. And if you go to either MormonExpression.com or go to Whitefields Educational, you will find a link up in the top right-hand corner that will allow you to present a donation. And so we're on this campaign to raise the $5,000 it will take to operate this place for the first 6 months. When we get that money, then we don't have to worry about whatever educational activities we have here having to cover the cost of the building. And we're planning on opening this center up to any organization or individual who's doing something that aligns with our mission. And then allowing this facility to be used free of charge. So we want to eliminate the pressure of cost for things like Mormon Expression Voices, which is a great service, but is not a real revenue maker. And also for whatever sort of therapeutic or cultural or educational activities can be here. So I invite all of you who have benefited from some degree or the other from the podcast to throw a couple bones that way and help us reach that goal by the end of the year of our $5,000. Bill, you know about fundraising.
Yeah, that's always a tricky.
It's not as fun as you think when I'm out shilling for money. But all the money for this just goes purely to the operational cost of this building. So I think it's a worthy cause. Okay, let's talk about the news. A couple of interesting stories. Today is November 11th, 2014, And this very morning, New York Times, above the fold, front page, the LDS article on Joseph Smith polygamy, you know, made the cover. That's big news in and of itself. And the story was that the church finally openly acknowledges the Smith's polygamy and acknowledges the polyandry, that that women were marrying multiple men at the same time, which is something the church has always denied. You know, what's funny is you read a lot of by the egghead sort of church scholars, they'll always say, well, polygamy, but it was actually polygyny. And right, that's always been a sleight of hand they used to get you away from it's actually polyandry was practiced, which was Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, those guys went around to members of the church and said, we're going to marry your wives.
Or didn't tell them.
Or indeed didn't tell them. And it was a heartbreaking situation. Well, it's openly acknowledged. And, apparently the church doesn't know that there's an age before 15, which is 14. Because they do acknowledge that Helen Mar Kimball was indeed 14 when she married.
Just shy of 15.
Just shy of 15. The story.
Three months shy.
We covered the article before. There's really nothing new in here, but the story is that now everybody's picked up on the fact that the cat's out of the bag. And we'll see where it goes from here. But I mean, that's big news.
It's interesting. Kate Kelly posted on her site today that she heard about it on the radio while driving her car in downtown Nairobi. So this has hit the big news.
The church has been out sort of famously. I mean, I remember a story from the 70s, the church always hiring like Madison Avenue, New York represented New York marketing firms and trying always to get themselves understood. There's been a belief among the inner core that if only people understood us, and you can see this in the ethos behind Meet the Mormons, where if you watch like Jeffrey Holland's insider direction, it's clear that he believes if people would just see how cool we are. The church has been doing this for a long time. Dale Murphy, the old baseball guy, who is the little gymnast from the 84 Olympics. What's the name again? No, she wasn't Mormon. There was a male. He was a Mormon who was a medalist. And you know, Steve Young and all these guys that the church, if we can just show famous people, then they'll see that we're not weird and then they'll listen to us. And this still goes on today with the tours of the temple where, I don't know, the last time I went on, they were in complete silence. And the belief is if people would just go see our mahogany and fine carpets, they'll realize that God has restored his church on the earth today.
Well, they're actually, renting out the, four major digital billboards in New York Times for the entire month of December.
Well, and if you go, I've seen the Book of Mormon musical twice. I saw it once in Portland, once in Denver, and both playbills, the church had bought a full page ad in the playbill, saying, "Hey, you've seen the musical, now find out how we really are." Well, I think probably the musical's more closer to how we really are than whatever propaganda they're going to slick at you.
Yeah.
Okay. The other story, and this is a telling story for a lot of reasons, and I like that it's a lead into what we're going to talk about. An LDS bishop who happens to be a blogger for the Jewish Journal in California, named Mark Pratis. I don't even know how to pronounce his name. He came out and was celebrating the fact that because the Republicans took over the Senate, Harry Reid will now lose his seat. Harry Reid has been fascinating to me because he is the highest ranking and most powerful Mormon to ever achieve power. He was the Senate majority leader. Fourth in line for the presidency. He's well spoken. I mean, there's things I disagree with him about, but extremely well-spoken, very intelligent, highly respected man, and he's a little bit more of a centrist. He's not sort of an extremist Democrat. And Mike Tannehill, our friend Mike, who's been on the podcast, is a Vegas Mormon himself, and he'll tell you that all the members hate him with a passion down there. But so this writer, this Mark, who's a bishop, and he tagged himself in the article as a bishop. That's telling. So he's asserting his Mormon authority. And he said this: I have no problem with an average Mormon in the pew who supports the Democratic Party because one of its issues or positions appeals to him. However, occupying a national Democratic leadership position is an entirely different matter. And he said, went on to say that Reed is a wonderful man, but not a man of serious religious faith. And then he questioned that he could be a Mormon or a Mormon in good standing and be able to hold that office. So here's a man who publicly attacks the most powerful Mormon out there, who the church should be like parading around. I made this point before. You go into Deseret Book and you'll see a bunch of, books by Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck. And you go look for the, well, Reed. They should be just having ghostwriter after ghostwriter. And then I think, what's about that nut from here who's in the Senate, been in the Senate way too long. Orrin Hatch. Yeah, that guy. That he has a whole like wall dedicated to him in Deseret Book. But here's Harry Reid, who the church should be saying, see, meet the Mormons, meet Harry Reid. But they've shied away from him. And, what's really telling about this story is the church comes out and says, now, we, this isn't us. We're politically neutral. An influential Mormon of power who asserts his office and says that Harry Reid shouldn't have a temple recommend, doesn't even get censured. Kate Kelly, in the church, she's a woman, so she has no authority, no power. She's nobody as far as the church is concerned, and they'll go after her, you know, with spikes and knives out.
Well, and the standard that they set is it's okay to believe these things personally, but when you go out publicly, that's when you've crossed the line. And here this has happened, and there's been nothing done.
Absolutely. Now, I think the what screams more loudly than anything with the church is where they refuse to take action, because we know that they'll take action on the tiniest minutia, on the littlest thing, like a BYU or whatnot. They will take action, and so whenever they don't, that speaks loud and clear. And the church wants it both ways. They want to be seen like they're politically neutral, but they are not at all based on how they go after things like this. So very interesting. And it goes to the idea we were talking about before, that the Mormon church is very closely watched now, and it's their own doing. That's what they wanted. They had an erroneous assumption that if everybody just got to know them, that they would all love them, but we find out, wait, you believe what? You do what? That's not okay. And this is a case like that.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is a listener-supported production. Visit our website, mormonexpression.com, to tip John's swear jar or become a subscriber and help keep the show running. Thank you very much. We can't do it without you.
So tonight we're going to talk about – I'm on the last of the podcasts that were in which I will be – sitting in the host chair. Every time the last few podcasts, I've said that my days are numbered. And every time somebody gets online and says, what is the podcast going away? Not, we hope not. We're still trying to find a new host, but we want to be very careful with that. But this is a topic that I really want to focus on. It's one that I think is fascinating. If I were to write a single book on Mormonism, this is the topic that I'd cover, because it is just – it's a telling chapter, and it's one that the church really, really wants to go down the memory hole, especially the stuff that we'll talk about that happened in the 60s and the late 50s.
Yeah.
But I think for people who grew up in the Mormon corridor especially, and if you look at like where the general authorities come from, I mean, the lion's share come from here, and there's this cultural element. This feeds Mormonism more than the church would acknowledge, and more than the church you would gather from reading the materials that are printed in foreign languages. And I posted something about this today online, and it's very true. If you want to really know how the church wants people to view it and how it views itself, don't read what it's putting on its website. Read what it's translating into Spanish. And that will give you because they have control of their message there, at least they think they do. And some people have made argument that like in Germany, for example, where the church has been really declining in numbers, was one of the countries where there got to be an early, quote unquote, anti-Mormon presence online. And you see the results. So the church really wants to control its message. And this is one of those things that they do not want to get out there. I've said before, there is a reason why you cannot search for any church articles before 1971 on their website. We'll talk about some of the things that have been said in those tonight. It's just so fascinating that under the guise of modern revelation and restoration, these principles, that founded Mormonism and set us apart from all the Protestants, that I would dare say 90% of what's been said from the pulpit in Salt Lake City, the church is embarrassed about and wants to bury, that should raise a question mark in people's head. If we are the one and only true church, and we are the ones who have modern restoration and all this stuff, why are we so fucking wrong on every point over the past 170 years?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So, like blacks in the priesthood, right? The point I've made is that if this was a revelation for us to give the priesthood to the blacks, why was it that we were the last organization on the earth to get that message other than, say, South Africa?
It's a great question. And even when I was a kid growing up in the 80s, there were still people actively discouraged interracial relationships and things like – I bet if you went to some corners of Provo and Highland, you could still hear some rumblings of that. Maybe people have learned their lesson. I don't know. So let's go back. Let's go back to the beginning. At the beginning of the Utah Territory, when Brigham came here, he was always duplicitous. He was he was about strategic placement. So he was always playing three sides. He was trying to petition the government. Because remember, when the Mormons left Nauvoo, they were leaving American territory. Utah at the time was technically Mexican territory. And they knew it. They knew they were crossing out of American territory. But at the time, he started entering into negotiations with the U.S. government right away, and he was trying to achieve statehood or official territory at the same time that they were looking at potentially establishing their own state of Deseret, their own theocracy in the West. At the same time, they were working other angles. And so I think some people look and say, well, look, they always wanted to be a part, but only kind of. And what happened in the 50s, of course, in the 1850s, we have the Reformation, where they go nuts. And of course, we have things like, Mountain Meadows Massacre that are a result of that. And you read, if you get the Journal of Discourse kicks in about that time, and you just read some crazy shit from that time. And I mean, they were calling for blood on every corner, and they were rebaptizing everybody and all this sort of stuff. So you have this fierce independence, but also wanting to be separate. So that goes along. And they were hoping, Brigham Young and others were banking on the destruction of the Union in the Civil War. Yeah. At the time, they believed that this was the prelude to the destruction of the United States, mm-hmm. and that the war would just leave the East decimated, and then the Deseret Kingdom would arise as this power. After the war was clear that it was over and reparation started from then they sort of backed away from that. Fast forward to the end of polygamy. Brigham Young dies. We lose a vision. John Taylor kind of tries to run with it. After John Taylor, we don't really have the sort of, Fidel Castro leader we had in, Brigham Young. Whenever I think Brigham Young, I see Fidel Castro in my head, by the way. Yeah, Brigham Young should have a cigar and a revolutionary hat. So we go into post-polygamy. And by that point, like the identity that had been built up, this Mormon identity was sort of gone. And it's on the rocks for a while, but we have this shift over in the early 20th century where having multiple wives was a loyalty test to get into the leadership. And then suddenly we have to go 180 degrees, and having multiple wives will not allow you to get into leadership position. And so if you look from that time to about the Depression, you see this real struggle for Mormon identity. And actually, it's a brilliant time. If you go find some of the Sunday school manuals from the time, they're full of like poetry and literature and like, because they were moving away from this polygamist identity route, but they hadn't established a new identity yet. And of course, the 20s before the Depression, before the Dust Bowl, was a wonderful time all across the world. It was very progressive, very open, a lot of social movement. And then we hit the Depression, we hit the Dust Bowl, we get into World War II, things kind of go to hell, and people start retreating back into fundamentalism. What this gives the Mormons is a new chance to grab onto a new identity. And that new identity is, well, we were outsiders before because we were polygamists and, you know, we were all about independent rights and they were against national whatever. But now they become uber Americans. Now they're going to out American the Americans. And what's interesting is during World War I, Mormons kind of sat on the sideline because, during World War I, there was deferment for farmers. And since we were so rural, there weren't very many people from this area that actually served in World War I. But World War II was different. And now we start getting engaged in this national dialogue a lot more. Utah is finding its own place with education and with different elements. We've gone past the time of the railroad. So now we're a player in the national scene. And this vacuum that was left by the drop of polygamy and that fundamentalist isolation from the United States, in my view, was replaced by an overzealous patriotism, a Reader's Digest version of patriotism, that really took off post World War II. Now you have to remember, that I've done some research on this fact, and the Mormon, desire for food storage. We have to tie this in. Came out, basically post Nauvoo. Now the Mormons had been chased out of Missouri in 31, 32. They've been chased out of Kirtland, 36. They were in the northern counties in Missouri in 37, 38, and they got chased out of that. During that time, if you recall, Joseph and Sidney and all those guys were in prison. So the exodus from Missouri to Nauvoo was headed up by the 12 under the leadership of Brigham Young. And Brigham Young really showed his mettle at this point. He showed that he could lead and garner the members. And because that's really where, in my opinion, that's really where he cut his teeth in church leadership. Brigham Young really was more about temporal affairs than Joseph Smith was always about weird metaphysics and mummies and shit like that. But Brigham Young, I mean, he jumped right in the pool where he had to get all these poor immigrants out of Missouri and into Nauvoo. And so when they start preparing for the second exodus, the exodus from Nauvoo West, they started preparing right after Joseph Smith died. And by 45, they had a standard set up, and one of the standards was a year's worth of food. And they really enforce it after 47, because you can read the manifest for the wagons in 46, they crossed the river and went over into winter quarters. And then it was 47 when they went to Utah. So it was when they got there, they don't really talk about this in Utah history very much, but they went and said, this is the place. They kind of hung out for about 10 days and they all turned around and went back. There was a few people who stayed, but Brigham Young and crew all went back. Shortly they learned that they weren't ready, and they actually stopped immigration for about 10 years, because they were living in like shitty adobe huts, and it was a miserable time. The people who stayed in Utah those first years until the mid-50s were practically starving to death. This is the stories you read about them going out in the winter and digging for sego lily bulbs and stuff like that, because they didn't have any food. So at that point, that's when Brigham really starts pushing and saying, if you're going to come out here, you need to come prepared. And the immigration stays, this wagon centric immigration stays until 69 or is 68 or 69 when the when the railroad was completed. At that point, I think the last pioneer to come over on the plains was like 69, the year after the railroads. And after that point, immigrants start coming across on the rail. But before then, it was very important because when you got to Salt Lake, you weren't going to live in Salt Lake. They were going to send you out to BFE, right? And they needed you to have those materials so they didn't have to fund that. That is the genesis, the beginning of this whole food storage paradigm. And then, of course, you're living out in the frontier a long way from everything. And the Mormons, for most of the 19th century, are very poor when it comes to currency. Without currency, they can't buy and import goods from the East Coast. So they're oftentimes relying on this self-reliance to get things into the Bishop's storehouse because the church wants to convert Bishop's storehouse donations to capital so they can buy things from the East Coast, things that they need. So there's this strong ethos of being self-supportive because the church doesn't want to take that on and they're trying to build their own economy.
So they re-grab onto that. Just after World War II, that becomes a central pillar of, you know, this independence, uber patriotism, but this self-reliance thing. I mean, that's a perfect storm.
Absolutely. And then you have, of course, the Depression and stuff leading up to it. It didn't hit Utah as hard, but it hit the entire economy. And even things like the flu epidemic of 1918 did impact out here where, especially if you're out in the middle of nowhere, Idaho, and, you know, five or six people die of the flu, you've got this problem. So there's this continual emphasis on self-reliance. And I believe it really comes from this church's sort of communalism where the church really feeds off of tithing. And yet from 1918, 1923, they're not getting a lot of currency at this point. They're still getting a lot of farm goods in. So they really need that's the whole economics of the church is to convert that rural production into capital.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the church handbook of instructions for decades only covered one topic, and that was the collection of tithing and putting that into the bishop's storehouse and then how much the bishop could keep as his personal.
Absolutely. And even the whole idea of a bishop as an ecclesiastical leader, this comes along long later. You know, when we a week or two ago with Lindsay, we were talking about the bishop who castrated the guy down in Ephraim. But you can't think about that dude being like an ecclesiastical leader. You have to think about him being more like the governor in The Walking Dead, right? That's they were local tyrannical leaders of the economy. By tyrannical, I mean they were autonomous, but they were the economic powerhouse. And it's only later that bishops became this evangelical sort of religious office.
Well, our whole view of the church today is starkly different from the way it was in the early 1910s, 1920s. Sacrament meeting attendance was like 17%.
Well, and even if you go 30 years before that, 40 years before that, sacrament meeting was a stake function.
Right.
There'd be tabernacles, but you know, you see tabernacles from 1870, but you don't see any ward houses from 1870. It's because they weren't building them. That's a later addition. Okay. So that leads us into World War II. John Birch was a Baptist preacher in China who was we're shrouded in mystery at this point, who was shot by the communists in China in 1945. He was proselyting and he was out there in 1945 and he was shot and killed. So Welsh, who started the John Birch Society, claims he was the first casualty of the Cold War. Now, famously, if you've watched the movie or read any history, you know the Patton said, I want to keep these tanks rolling east. We're not going to stop at Berlin. We need to keep going. Of course, the communist revolution happened in the 1917. You know, with Lenin and Stalin and these guys taking over from the Bolsheviks. And you see that in the Soviet Union, there was a lot of poverty, but they started cranking the machine up to the point that they turned around. I mean, in World War I, famously, they would line up, and the Russian troops would line up, and they'd have the front guy who had a gun, and then they line up behind him. So if the front guy got killed, then you'd pick up the gun to keep fighting because they didn't have enough material to fight the war. And by the time the World War II rolls around, they've been able to vastly transform the Eastern bloc. And of course, the Eastern bloc as we know it came about because as the communists moved into Germany at the end of World War II, they just never gave up their territory.
Never left, yeah.
So there's already starting to be an idea in the West. We're understanding that we might have a problem here. But there was this tenuous agreement between the Soviets and you know, Britain and the United States. But at that point, we are already starting to see that there'd be a problem. So a lot of the troops come home and they just, in my opinion, they wanted to retreat from the horrors of the first 50 years of the 20th century. And we moved into the suburbs and like to fetishize this nuclear family life. The economy was going like gangbusters.
We created this golden ideal that never existed in order to be able to rally around that idea. That became kind of this founding notion.
Absolutely. And I call this period, I've called it several times until like about 61 or 62, the golden age of the church. Because the American ideals and the Mormon ideals, which had both been wavering all over the place, suddenly locked in place. And you know, Mormon ideals, it started even with Joseph Smith, you know, like the founding fathers were these quasi-religious figures. Well, post-World War II, America sort of took on the same sort of attitude. And it just became the quasi-essential American religion at that point. And that's when we took on and started fetishizing in the church these trappings of American, basically imperialism of the 40s and 50s, like the suit and the white shirt and all these elements of like American corporate culture and American economic growth. We took on as religious symbols. So it was this perfect time. Now, of course, Joseph Smith Christianity was very sort of Zoroastrian. It was very black and white. It was very, there's God and there's the devil and they are in this battle. So you come out of that sort of black and white thinking out of World War II and lo and behold, here are the communists, right?
Yeah.
The ultimate enemy. And what every good conservative movement needs is an enemy. And we had them. So to me, you have this perfect storm. Looking for identity, finding identity in this American flag waving, just wrapping themselves up completely in the flag. And frankly, that was justification for a lot of the horrors, I believe. This is another opinion of my own. A lot of the horrors that had been done by the Americans in World War II, we only have come to grips with these, I think, last 10 or 20 years. You know, we did some awful things. And we did it in the name of winning the war. You know, we talk about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We don't talk so much about the fact that we firebombed Tokyo, which was made of wood, and we killed 400,000 people in Tokyo.
Or firebombed Dresden.
Dresden, famously, in Slaughterhouse 5, portrayed. We knocked the city off the map, you know, and we killed lots of, it was the American movement to kill. The way we run the war is we decided we weren't going to target military targets anymore. We were going to target every fucking thing we could find. We were going to kill every man, woman, and child until the enemy capitulated. I love America, but that was our strategy, and you got to understand that. Well, a lot of these guys came back from this after dropping firebombs on children in Dresden, and it became easier in my mind for them to wrap themselves up in this American exceptionalism saying, well, we had to do it. We were right. Think about somebody like Boyd K. Packer. Boyd K. Packer was the navigator on a bomber. That's what he did in the war. He dropped bombs on Europe. And when you think about that, that you're sitting up there on that site and you're watching those buildings and you know what's going on down there and you're killing all those people, that kind of thing fucks with you. And you can come back and kind of say, well, I'm going to find a new super religious identity. And I think that was part of what fueled Mormonism up to this point. This is a real downer, this one. Not as many chuckles. Okay, so the 40s, we come into the 1950s. And at this time, this is really when counterculture starts coming. And the counterculture is really a rebirth of those things that were alive in the 20s and 30s and really were an extension of the whole Enlightenment. But, you know, when you think about like the beatniks and stuff like that and the early so-called hippies, we're really talking about the 50s.
Right.
At this point when this stuff starts emerging. And 1958 becomes a pivotal year.
You have to figure anything when you've created this kind of iconoclastic idealism around, this Uber America, anything that's counter to that strikes fear. And you have to react against it. And you have to react hard and fast.
Right. So you're absolutely right. So the 50s see this solidifying around this counterculture, this rejection of this new American jingoism, basically. Yeah. And also you see the solidifying of the Soviet bloc. The Berlin Wall was built in 61, in 60.
Right.
Before that, the fences weren't there and people were strewing across the lines, right? So it was unclear through the 50s what would happen. It was this tenuous period where we started seeing this new movement, you know, places like San Francisco or New York City start having new things come about. And you have all these GIs, by the way, who are going to college and suddenly finding their new voice. I'm thinking of people like Lenny Bruce. You know, he started really his routines in the 50s. And so we're starting to feel uneasy with what's going on. And of course, the 50s also see the birth of the civil rights movement. And this gets white America scared out of their shorts. So 1958, a couple of important things happen. The formation of the John Birch Society, and Cleon Skousen publishes his book, The Naked Communist. If I were going to do the list of the top 10 most important influential books in Mormonism, this is one of them, the Naked Communist. And it wasn't that long ago that you would find one in everybody's house and six copies of the DI. You can probably still go to the DI and find a bunch of copies of The Naked Communist right now. Mine's packed up right now, I'm sad to say. So let's talk about the players here. Cleon Skousen graduated from law school, I believe, in 1940, and he became a special agent for the FBI. And he worked for the FBI for 11 years. The reason I put special agent is there was later the FBI release said he was a cleric, a clerk. He wasn't like a gun. He wasn't a G-man. He was just an insider. He came back and he was a BYU professor, and he was a professor of history at BYU. Then he became the chief of police at Salt Lake City for 4 years, I think until 60 or 61. Interestingly enough, he lost his job when he raided a poker game, by, I think it was the mayor at the time. Mm-hmm. It was quote unquote, it was a friendly poker game. You know, they were playing for pennies and they raided an illegal gambling thing. And he lost his job over that. But Skousen went back to BYU. And he is a noted historian among Mormons. Glenn Beck still touts his book, The 5,000 Year Leap. Have you ever read The 5,000 Year Leap?
Yeah.
I have not. What is it?
It's a history of the, it's kind of a scriptural history of 5,000 years, basically imposing Mormon Jews on the history of the world.
Okay, so he wrote a series called the 4,000 years, the 3,000 years, the 2,000 years. And I guess this is an accumulation of his later work on that. A relative of mine, when she was in high school 10 years ago, her parents decided to put her in one of the Mormon charter schools in Provo. And they actually used Skousen as their history textbooks. Yeah. She was in school for like 6 months, and then her parents figured this is a raw deal and got her back, and it took like a year and a half of summer school for her to get back on track. It was so terrible. But Skousen is still used today in these fundamentalist schools right here on the Wasatch Front as a historian. So Skousen writes The Naked Communist in 1958, and I have a quote here from David O. McKay, conference report, October 1959. Well, the era through which we are passing is no exception. On the flyleaf of the book The Naked Communist by W. Cleon Skousen, we find this quotation, and I admonish everyone to read that excellent book of Cleon Skousen's. The conflict between communism and freedom is the problem of our time. It overshadows all other problems. This conflict mirrors our age and its toils, its tensions, its troubles, and its tasks. On the outcome of this conflict depends the future of mankind. That is the prophet, the president of the church, in 1959, telling everybody in conference they need to read The Naked Communist and saying communism is the fight of our time. Have y'all read The Naked Communist? The Naked Communist is not as hot as it sounds. I was disappointed when I was about 12 and I pulled a copy off my dad's bookshelf. Very disappointed. The Naked Communist describes the tension in the Cold War. You know, so now we have the Cold War going on as a conspiracy. So what separates it from other tracts of this is it really introduces the idea of this vast communist conspiracy. And what it identifies key is that any type of cooperative agreement between the West and the Soviets is playing into their hands. So first of all, it says you do not make any sort of agreement with the communists. You can't, because that's what they want. It identifies things like civil rights movement as a puppet of the communist movement. That things like free speech, student rights movement, student newspapers, belittling American culture, saying anything wrong, having losing governmental control of student newspapers, and it promotes specifically the House Un-American Committee and any condemnation of loyalty oaths, it says, are all part of the communist plot. So it's not just a book that talks about there's this red and white thing, but it plays out this whole communist witch hunt that's going on in the 50s as being divinely inspired.
Right. Yeah. That's the important thing, is that not only is he laying this out, but he uses, proof texted scripture and quotes from, prophets in order to reinforce this whole thing. So it's got this stamp of religious, support. And
for sure. Now let's talk about Eisenhower a little bit. Eisenhower was, of course, a general in World War II, became president in the '50s, and he appoints a young upcomer named Ezra Benson to be Secretary of Agriculture. There's a long backstory as to why, but, Ezra Benson is the last of a particular kind. He was serving in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles as a prophet, seer, and revelator at the exact same time he was serving as Secretary of Agriculture. Now, at the time, people did not understand Mormons as well as they do now, so that would have meant nothing to them. They wouldn't realize they were putting a high-level official of the Mormon Church into this position of Secretary of Agriculture. Benson becomes really tied up with the John Birch movement that I was talking about before. And the John Birch movement really espouses this idea of the conspiracy, and they're the ones who really start pounding the New World Order conspiracy, that there is a communist conspiracy that's infiltrated all of American culture and the rest of the world, and anything that questions American values, questions the government, or anything is part of the communist conspiracy. And Benson really wants to join, according to the biography of David O. McKay by blah 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 Prince, yes. You know, he had access to the McKay papers, and he suggests that Benson really, really wanted to join the John Birch Society, but McKay would never let him. Even though McKay would promote it, and McKay would walk the line, but he did not let Benson ever actually join the organization. Now, Reed Benson, is Reed still down at BYU? He's a fucking nut job. If you ever had a chance to meet Reed Benson, he's his son, and he joined.
Right, and in many ways represented his dad through his membership. His dad joined vicariously this way.
Absolutely. And Benson would talk at their conferences. He would regularly write for their articles. And he was always trying to get McKay to have Welsh, the actually speak at LDS conference. I don't think he ever did. Did Welsh ever speak at conference?
No, but he tried all the time. And towards the end, when President McKay was becoming less coherent, he would constantly try and trick President McKay into having his picture on the cover of the magazine.
Right.
He would position as this is great national magazine. It's going to be great exposure and stuff. And then Joseph Fielding Smith would learn that it's the darn, and he would shut him down. And then he'd try again a few months later. And he would never say exactly what it was. He was just always trying to trick him into doing it.
And McKay was a genius about playing both sides. And so like Hubie Brown or some of those guys would come in and McKay would appease them and then Benson. And at the time, you have to understand that there was a lot of division and dissension among the church leadership. A lot of people thought Benson was a nutcase. And he was. And one of the reasons I can say that is Benson really did not like the civil rights movement at all. And for example, in his book, Civil Rights, Tool of Communist Deception, or his article, Civil Rights, comma, Tool of Communist Deception, written in 1968, the so-called civil rights movement as it exists today is used as a communist program for revolution in America. And they were saying this bullshit from the pulpit in the 60s. And, you know, the question is, why were the Mormons so late in recognizing civil rights and equality? Why did it wait till 78? Because they had to at least wait for the acid to boil down a little bit from the 60s, where they identify the entire civil rights movement as a communist plot.
Right, right.
And, of course, Benson famously wrote the introduction to the Black Hammer, which is an extremely racist book about this very topic.
Well, it got so bad. In 1963, Elder Benson spoke at the Logan Tabernacle, and it's a fairly – most it's been completely suppressed, but he stood there, and the premise of his talk was that the United States government had been so completely infiltrated by communists that the only reasonable response was armed overthrow of the government.
Okay, so we've established two of the Holy Trinity, Ezra Benson and of course, Cleon Skousen. The third party of the Holy Trinity was Ernie Wilkinson, who had taken over Brigham Young University as the president. And, of course, we see during the time we've talked about the John Birch Society, the Naked Communists specifically cited students. And, of course, you start seeing more and more protests and sort of progressive elements come out of the campuses. And so Wilkinson decided he was going to put an end to that. And as we mentioned a week or two ago on the podcast, he established his own secret police with students who he had spying on teachers. They were spying on other students. And this is where a lot of what defines Mormonism today, the no facial hair, the no short hair, that everyone had to wear like skirt, you know, women couldn't wear pants. It was really the counter culture that Wilkinson was pushing. And he was in league with Skousen. He was buddies with Skousen and with Benson. And these guys, first of all, saw a conspiracy everywhere. And there were purgings at this time of faculty, you know, the same sort of communist witch hunt where the arch conservatives start seeing this in every liberal arts department across the, you know, if you were a philosophy professor, you were a sociology professor, you were a communist, you know.
Yeah.
And we saw that play out right there at BYU. So this tenor starts to go away a little bit in the country in the 70s. But the Cold War is still active, right? And people stop seeing a huge communist conspiracy, and all they can see now are MX missiles. And for those of you like me who grew up in the 70s, you know, this is – when my parents went to school in the 50s, they did duck and cover. And when I went to school in the 70s, it's like, just kiss your ass goodbye. There's no, when you see the flash, it's just thank God that you're close enough to see the flash. And it's all over. I mean, it's hard. I don't know if millennials understand during the 80s and the late 70s, how real, the Cold War in terms of this mutually assured nuclear war was. So by that time, in my esteem, the games were over. And what we had is two superpowers staring each other down across the Atlantic and just their fingers on the trigger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mormons love this shit. because this played perfectly into the narrative, which, if you remember, Joseph Smith started the religion when they went out in missions, like in 32, 33, they were saying, you've got to move to Kirtland. You even should abandon your farms if you can't sell them, because Jesus is coming tomorrow. He's coming right now, and you need to get to Kirtland. You need to get to Missouri. And this message had always been along, but after 100 and something years, it starts to weaken until the blessed communists and the Red Scare come along.
This whole sense of millennialism revives. Everybody's certain that at the end of the century or before that this is going to happen. General authorities predicted it. There was a whole lot of that. And it really fed into this whole paranoia. And paranoia is good. If you want to like bind a group of people together and march them in one particular direction, that works really well.
Absolutely.
I just remember growing up hearing about how the Great Flood was the baptism of the earth, and then the nuclear explosions that will end, that will usher in the 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ, is the baptism by fire that the earth would then go through to usher in the end times or something.
Right, yeah. McConkie famously called it the nuclear holocaust, which surely must come.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So in Mormon doctrine, he spells it out right there. He calls it that. And that was, we were being taught at the time that 2000, it was over by 2000, and it was going to be nuclear holocaust. And the table had been set. We had the communists in Russia. We had this retreating into American. We'd already established the counterculture. You know, the hippies listening to NPR and shit like that were trying to bring us down from the inside. And we had the communists from the outside. And it was a beautiful message in terms of fear mongering.
It wasn't even in the hippies, right? Benson famously referred to Eisenhower as a knowing tool of the Communist Party, and which baffled Eisenhower and actually hurt his feelings, because he couldn't figure out what had happened. And Benson would harass J. Edgar Hoover constantly about his fears about these conspiracies, to the point where J. Edgar Hoover left a message for his secretary to always tell Benson that he was out of the office and he'd get back to him. And he stopped taking his phone calls because he was just obsessed with this sort of thing. And one of my favorites is General Conference. This was right after the Watts riots. Elder Benson and Reed both began this rumor, and I have no idea what it was based on, that groups of blacks from the Los Angeles area were going to get on buses and come up to Salt Lake and start a race riot during General Conference. And so the whole Temple Square was surrounded by state police during conference weekend, sure that there was going to be this influx of angry black people trying to tear down the church, because we were the last bastion of truth and have real vision. We were what was holding back the tide of the civil rights movement and the communists.
Absolutely. And there's a huge granary in Davis County, and there's a huge granary in Salt Lake City. The church is all about conspicuous wealth. I mean, they might criticize others for it, but holy shit. And those granaries are placed where they are for a good reason. And we start at the beginning talking about food storage. But what I want to point out is the church by this time had these subtle messages that were just brilliant. And you read Relief Society manuals from the 80s, and hell, the church even had like a survivalist guide. I have a copy of it from the late 80s. You know, talk about raising rabbits for food and stuff like that. I don't make this. People think I make this stuff up. I do not. Missionaries get eaten, and the church told people to raise rabbits for food. But you have this subtle message. You better have a year's worth of food storage. You better have it. Why would you need a year's worth of food storage? You know, and it's this perpetual state of fear and preparedness. Think about, I mean, the shelf life of that stuff is 6 months. 5 years tops before it's like lost all its nutritional value. Think about from a fiscal perspective, just since the end of World War II, how much money, time, and energy has been wasted on that shit. It's just, it boggles one's mind. And the church, you know, we know that they have armies of accountants. The church has to know that. But it's not about food storage, because food storage ultimately makes no sense. All right? Can we take a divergent story for here for a little bit? Let's say you could, in fact, store a year's worth of food storage, forgetting the fact that you would need like drums of cooking oil that's going to expire in 6 months, and you need a lot of fuel, and you need a good source of clean water, and you know, way to heat it all up and all that stuff. Let's forget about all that. Let's say you have all that in your basement. You go in your basement and you live off your year's worth of food storage because you don't have a 40-year food supply. You only have one fucking year. Then what happens? What happens then? Especially as Mormons get up and talk about, well, we're going to be prepared and our neighbors aren't. Yeah, well, not all of us who don't have food storage are going to starve to death, you motherfuckers. And when you come out of your little bunkers, then what? Hey, guys, sorry. Can I come play? Can I join? What are you preparing for? The idea is fundamentally ridiculous. Why would you want a year's worth of food storage? What emergency scenario would require you to have exactly 1 year's worth of food storage and no more? That you start narrowing down the possible circumstances where you need 1 year's worth of food, but you don't need any seeds and you don't need any animals and you don't need like a way to chop wood. It's just patently ridiculous. It's all about keeping this fear going, this constant fear of the enemy at the gates. And the book that Benson, we talked about how David O. McKay recommended Naked Communists in 72. Benson recommended a book called, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, which is like Naked Communists on steroids. Mm-hmm. So they're promoting this fear culture in Utah. And come 2000, it's all going to go to hell. Now, something happened, and I remember it loud and clear. In 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. I was in high school. And the rest of the world celebrated, and the Mormons said, wait a minute, we do not know how to process this information. Because they had this worldview constructed that fed into this religious narrative, and all of a sudden, everything took a 90-degree turn.
Yeah.
And if, for those of you who were going to church at the time, were old enough to remember, most Mormons identified it as a communist plot.
Right. Yeah, the notion was that this was they faked their own death in order to slide in under the radar and take over and erode us at the roots.
And you have guys who emerged in the '80s like Bo Greitz, who still ride the tide after this of survivalism and the fear of the Eastern elite, and of the fear of the
intellectuals.
The intellectuals. And so that's the '90s. It emerged 1993 when we see the purge of, you know, the September 6th. We see the purging of BYU. I don't think it's coincidental that happened when it did, because again, what framework did I frame in the beginning? That you had this identity that the church had, that we're this polygamous sort of separatist band. We gain statehood. We have to get rid of that. We need a new identity. Well, we have this identity in the '80s of this religious, it was basically a religious shell around the Cold War is what Mormonism was at the time. And then that goes away. Well, what do you have to have a new set of enemies, and who are they? They're intellectuals, homosexuals, and feminists, right?
Right, right. Well, and this, the fear of the other, right? And this hasn't gone away. About a year ago, at church, someone was talking about food storage and the need for food storage, and then asked if people had ammunition and weapons as part of that. And most of the people in the groups raised their hand. Yes, of course we have that. And he says, the reason I bring that up is that I've been working over in West Valley. And there are entire neighborhoods up there where there's nothing but Mexican restaurants. And I said, You're telling me that we need guns because bands of armed Mexicans are going to come down to Utah County to take our food storage.
Take your hard winter.
That's your strategy. But that kind of paranoia and fear still exists.
Yes, there's a video game. Did you guys see this? It came out about a month ago. It was like a Kickstarter campaign. And there is some argument as whether or not it's parody, but we think it's real. There's some Mormon program because of the – anyway. Mormon programmers came up with this video game in which there is a zombie apocalypse and the world falls apart except for the Mormons because they have food storage. So then as a Mormon, you have to go kick ass for all the zombies because you're the only ones who survive, right? Yeah, yeah. And it's actually a play on that whole constitution hanging by a thread that the Mormons will save us all. But yeah, I mean, that would be great. Yeah, you shoot people. You know, I always used to joke and I would say it in church all the time that my food storage consisted of ammunition, toilet paper, and chocolate. And I figured I could get everything else I needed with that holy trinity. But
if you stop and think about it, right, and you look at this huge kind of fringe Tea Party movement that really is well represented in the Mormon community, right? This fear of the other, the certainty that the government is going to take over because it's been infiltrated by the liberals and that we're the last bastion of survival and safety in the world. All of that has deep historical and religious roots in the community that they've been raised in. And it's inextricable from their fundamental belief system. And so this isn't some weird thing that's just rising up out of nowhere. This is decades of priming and training people. And this is what you get. You get this kind of extreme paranoia and fear-based view of the world.
Well, there are those who talk about the reformers of the day talking about the church changing on issues of feminism and homosexuality and whatnot. I think what those people forget is I challenge them all to go and start in 1950 and read all the improvement eras from 1950 to 1970. And how many people of power in the church came of age during that time?
Right.
Until all those people die off, because those beliefs, those patterns are so deeply ingrained in the church. That's why I said at the beginning, a lot of this stuff, they want to go down the memory hole, and the church has tried to purge it from the official record, but they can't purge it from the minds and the attitudes of all the members who came of age during that time and listened to this shit be prattled on and on about for years.
What's really interesting is that they're oblivious to any of the history prior to that period.
Yeah.
Right. When women were empowered, when women could participate in much more meaningful ways in church none of that exists as far as they're concerned. Just the church started in the 1950s and that's their paradigm. And there is no other paradigm.
Absolutely. So the situation today, of course, Jesus didn't come in 2000. And that kind of fucked things up for us all. and then we saw the individuals like Glenn Beck, right? And Glenn Beck is sort of this neo-Mormon conservative. And he really is playing off this Benson and all those sort of guys. And there's still a cadre of these church sort of insiders from these powerful families who still follow this. And they believe that Ezra was sort of slighted by the Bensonites don't like Hinckley. They think he was a slick, willy sort of marketing guy. And they'll say that when Benson was sort of incapacitated, Hinckley kind of came in with the modern church that we have now. And this has been the Hinckley period. And Hinckley actually came to power underneath not Yoda. What was Kimball.
Kimball. Yeah. I mean, to Benson's credit, there wasn't a lot of this kind of crazy political stuff when he became president of the church.
Well, but if you listen to his grandson, that's because he was basically incapacitated by the time.
Right. Yeah.
My father, you know, I one time as
well, he managed to take on women pretty good when he was president of the church.
Yeah, it's true. I asked my father in high school. I sort of discovered some of the stuff and said, "What the fuck, Dad?" And he said I was really scared. And my father is a deeply religious man, very intelligent, and I don't mean to slight him at all. But he said I was really quite taken aback when Benson was put in, and you know, because he had lived through that period and he'd heard all that shit in the 60s. But he said it was a testament to him that Benson never said that stuff again. So he's kind of playing loose with the definition of prophet, which Mormons do a lot, which is saying, well, when he became the prophet, then he never said this again. Wait a minute. Wasn't he a prophet time? Steve Benson, his grandson, will tell you that for most of the time he was out of commission, but you know, he did really, hammer on the Book of Mormon and pride and that sort of stuff.
Right. And women come home.
Yes. And women should the ERA, of course, in the late 70s, you know, he and Hinckley were big in those maneuverings. So today we have Glenn Beck, and Sean Hannity and some of those, the uber right. But, you know, the question of Mormons and Republicanism, you really can't answer that question, without looking at the history. And I was reading something recently where somebody was basically a convert and they were making an argument saying, well, look at all the ways that the church aligns with some of these democratic principles of the Democratic Party. That only works if you're blind to the history of the church and realize that during the middle part of the 20th century, we had so polarized these camps to make the Republican Party basically a quasi-religious institution.
Right.
And all these things, the John Birch Society, the Naked Communists, Skousen's teachings, Benson's teachings, McKay, the stuff that he said, it all shaped this cocoon around Republican conservatism and hyper-Republican conservatism that lives to this day. And it's all a root of this reaction to the Red Scare.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's probably nothing that has shaped the modern church more than that particular thing, that this reaction against communism was it. I mean, it wasn't Brigham Young. It wasn't the Move West. It wasn't our isolation. I mean, really, the modern church was forged under the threat of communism.
And if you want to see what a lot of what, say, 20-30% of any Mormon ward in the corridor is, listen to Glenn Beck. And he still goes on about communist conspiracies. That an idea that I think to most people just seems patently ridiculous on its surface, like the Book of Mormon and shipbuilding. But these people really believe. And, you know, it's sort of like a few good men. If you could just get them on the witness stand and badger them, then they would start complaining about the communists and the communist plot. It's still alive among Mormon believers.
But they don't know much about it, right? I mean, that's the challenge, right? Ask them if they've read the Communist Manifesto. I mean, it's only a few pages long.
Right.
No, there's no effort. This inability to differentiate between socialism and communism, it's all that big thing. So there's this big brush that they paint everything that's different from me as dangerous.
And there's this, I remember in seminary, these convoluted explanations as to why the United Order wasn't a communist system and why the church welfare system is not a socialistic system. You can ask Mormons questions like, do we have a socialized school system in the United States? The answer is yes. Our school system is socialized. Oh, no. They'll be offended and give you a long-winded explanation that makes no sense as to why we're not. And this has been a trial and still is today. This of the American exceptionalism that comes from the pulpit and our European brothers and sisters, and it goes way back, because we've been pushing out this American propaganda bullshit for a lot of years, and the rest of the world says, I thought you were a global church,
right? Yeah. The most well-attended school board meeting in the Alpine School District, which is in Utah County, happened over, there was a mission statement published by the school district that their goal was to create, to help students become effective and meaningful members of the American democracy. And this meeting was over the fact that we're not a democracy, we're a republic. And people showed up in droves to complain that they had used the word democracy in this statement. And it was like, it was Armageddon. It was in the news. You couldn't drive down the road past the school district. There were people protesting outside because of this very narrow view of what we are.
It's crazy. I mean, it's embarrassing, really. There's a lot of principles and ideals that the Republican Party holds that I am also hold. But God damn it, God, you got to get away from this crazy stuff, and especially here in Utah. This conspiratorial view, and the problem with the conspiracy theory, I've thrown that word out about 20 times this podcast. It's really pseudoscience taken to an extreme. It's the same mental gymnastics that happen with religious thinking where you run everything through that filter. You can never convince a conspiracy theorist they're wrong. First of all, they'll stop busting out obscure things you've never heard of, you know?
Right.
And secondly, everything gets filtered through this. There is no, you know, it's like when the communist bloc fell apart. Well, to them, it was all a plot. By who, they couldn't tell you. But it was going to, you know, it was going to resurface, and it's incubating somewhere, waiting to spring up on us. And every time, like, federal government comes up with a common standard for what fifth graders should learn. Oh my God. This is the same as the 5-year plans under Stalin. Watch him for what he's going to be burning Jews next, you know? and there's just no nuance in their worldview. But
well, and it's a shotgun argument, right? And that's the biggest problem is that they come at you with 100 arguments at the same time, and you can't you refute one, and they just slide over into the next one, and so you literally cannot have a conversation.
Yeah, you know, if you point out, they say, "Oh, there are divinely inspired founding fathers," and you start showing stuff where they're criticizing Christianity, or that Benjamin Franklin liked to get it on with loose French women, you know, then that's all a lie, right? You're just trying to, just slander. You know, the same thing they used to say about Joseph Smith until this article came out.
Well, the American Heritage School, which is across the street from the Temple in American Fork, right in their foyer, they have this bronze sculpture of Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and George Washington kneeling together in prayer, which is like couldn't have possibly happened on an alternate planet even. I mean, they were so far removed from that sort of a thing, especially Thomas Jefferson. But that's kind of the core foundation that they're indoctrinating these children with.
And be a patriot or not, love the U.S. or not, a lot of this stuff is built on flat-out lies.
Yeah.
Blatant untruths. And it's not worth it. You know, it's better to have a good view of history. Like I said in the middle of the podcast, we're better off understanding the atrocities that the Americans committed in World War II than we are whitewashing it into some sort of cheapened, fiction. And it's Veterans Day today, and I understand and appreciate the sacrifice that many have made, but that is cheapened when you have to tell a lie in the service of some greater truth. If anything history has taught us for the last 10,000 years is that does not work. It's always better to go in and understand what really things are. And the church is learning this lesson very painfully with every bump, with every bruise these days. And unfortunately, they are mishandling it in a way, well, depending on how you see it. The actions that they are doing right now in the last couple years, especially now, are doing more damage to them than anything somebody like me could do.
Yeah. And this kind of embracing of the military by the church seems so counterintuitive given the fact that we claim to be Christian, right? That this doesn't map up, that somehow we've created this new corporate Jesus that's a general, right, who runs an army. And we've embraced this kind of military thing where anybody who even ever drove past a military base, we can now call them a hero. And we've cheapened the word, right? Because I have a hard time believing that the guy whose job was pumping gas into the cars in the motor pool is the same hero as the guy who jumped on a live grenade to save his friends in the foxhole.
Yeah, this is a sore spot for me. The word hero means nothing anymore. We've destroyed it. But yeah, let's go back to Hercules. That was a hero. I'm just going to tease this, and if I had another year worth of podcasts, we would go through this. But Mormonism actually has an interesting relationship with the military, which is we give it a lot of lip service, but we really don't like people serving in it. And if you are a Mormon veteran, you will know this, that you're tainted. And Mormonism has an interesting relationship with the armed services.
That's a good point, yeah.
But we sure as hell like other people going and fighting for us, but not us. All right. Well, I think we've done it. I think we've talked about the Red Scare, and it's alive and well in Utah County. Thanks, Bill. You brought a lot of flavor to the
thanks.
Podcast.
It was fun.
Let's see. Do I have any announcements? Nope. All right. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is recorded live before a studio audience in Salt Lake City on Tuesday nights at 6:30. Come down and join the audience, take part in the podcast, and meet John and the panelists. The Mormon Expression Podcast is produced by the Whitefield Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find out about our counseling services and other special events.